Seneca 10, Exile 2, A Tale of Three Women. Welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Cneius Seneca. This is podcast 10, and it'll cover the latter part of Seneca's exile on Corsica, when his fate was determined, directly or indirectly, by three very different women. One was the Empress Messalina, Claudius's wife, who'd had Seneca exiled in the first place. The second was Agrippina, last surviving daughter of the late, great, yet still hugely popular Germanicus. Like the twin snakes on the god Mercury's caduceus, her and Seneca's destinies seem to have woven around each other from at least AD 39. And the third woman, about whom we'll speak in this podcast, was Helvia, and she was Seneca's own mother. In AD 44, Seneca was still in exile on Corsica, and he was seething. His attempt to secure a recall by thinly veiling his plea in a consolation to Polybius, one of Emperor Claudius's closest administrative assistants, on the death of his brother, had failed miserably. Claudius had been on a high after his British campaign, and he was feeling pretty magnanimous. But for Seneca, the window of opportunity had been pretty short. Perhaps he'd rushed the consolation to Polybius, fearing maybe that he'd missed the moment, and he'd ended up composing a rather unsubtle shambles. Or perhaps it had been simply too brazen, attempting to get to the emperor by shanghaiing the grief of one of his closest and best beloved advisers. Moreover, Claudius was no idiot. He must have seen right through Seneca's attempt. And it's also not inconceivable that Messalina got hold of the work as well, and she definitely had it in for Seneca. Seneca knew that the time to strike was in the period leading up to Claudius's British triumph in Rome, which probably took place sometime in early AD 44. The ancient commentator Suetonius, writing a good couple of generations after the events he describes, says that the triumphal procession itself was absolutely splendid. Claudius, he says, had invited provincial governors to Rome to witness the spectacle. And he'd also, and this was something that would have got Seneca all excited, recalled a variety of exiles to be spectators at the same occasion. And perhaps that's what Seneca got wind of and prompted him to the hasty, but ultimately futile, composition of the Ad Polybium. Personally, I don't think that Claudius would have appreciated Seneca trying to grease him up through what was, in reality, not much more than a begging letter disguised as a condolence piece. But I also don't think that Seneca managed to sneak his effort past Messalina either, and it was probably a combination of the two factors, Claudius's distaste at Seneca's underhand tactics and the emperor wanting to spare himself an ear bashing from his wife, that put an end to that particular attempt of Seneca's to get back to Rome. And depending on precisely how badly the Consolatio Ad Polybium was received at the imperial court, it may even have had the opposite effect to that which Seneca intended, and actually lengthened rather than shortened his stay in exile. That Messalina still wielded huge influence in AD 44 is demonstrable by the order of the triumph itself. If you'd been an onlooker in the vast crowd in Rome that day, you'd have seen Claudius, of course, riding at the head of the procession. But immediately behind him came Messalina in a covered chariot, and only behind her would you have seen Claudius's generals who'd won triumphal regalia in the British campaign. Suetonius, who, as I said a little earlier, was writing a good generation or two after the British triumph, does have a predilection for reporting salacious gossip and sensationalist snippets. But where it concerns Claudius's seeming deferment to Messalina's wishes, he sums up what appears to have been in most people's minds. Indeed, writes Suetonius, one might say everything Claudius did throughout his reign was dictated by his wives and freedmen. He practically always obeyed their whims rather than his own judgment. Now, I don't think that's entirely true. Claudius, in my opinion, was far too smart to let his wives and freedmen dictate matters of high state. Sure, he may have let them get their way in matters he considered of little consequence, like Messalina throwing Seneca under the bus as part of the Julia Lavilla adultery accusations, for instance. But he never really let it get so out of hand that taking his own hand off the rudder of state would send the ship of Rome careering out of control. Messalina, however, gradually started taking greater and greater liberties with her husband's somewhat cavalier attitude to her behaviour. She began, it seems, to believe she could get away with whatever the hell she wanted, and she started to behave as disgracefully as she liked. When acting on a whim, she didn't care how high up the social pecking order her victim sat. For instance, she trumped up charges against the ex-consul Valerius Asiaticus so that she could get her hands on his beautiful gardens. People who slighted her or criticised her, or of whom she was jealous, or even those she simply just disliked, began to disappear. And Messalina had always despised the daughters of Germanicus, Julia and Agrippina, possibly because, as nieces of her husband Claudius, they were potential rivals for his affections. She'd done away with Julia by first of all getting her exiled on a charge of adultery, and then, once she'd been banished, urging her execution. It's said that Agrippina herself was only saved from Messalina's spite and cruelty because, around the time she was being especially targeted by the Empress, Messalina happened to become smitten with a handsome young Roman noble by the name of Gaius Silius, into whose household she started brazenly transferring slaves, freedmen, and even furniture from Claudius's royal palace. Tacitus, probably an overall more reliable ancient commentator than Suetonius, reckons that Claudius was ignorant of Messalina's adulterous carryings-on behind his back. But that can't have been the case, because Messalina appears to have made very little effort at discretion. I think Claudius just turned a blind eye to Messalina's promiscuity with other men, just as she turned a blind eye to Claudius's predilection for female maidservants. One commentator even goes as far as to claim that Messalina occasionally handpicked the slaves she sent to her husband's bedchamber. But eventually, Messalina went too far. There was only so much Claudius was willing to take, and when the relationship formed from her lusts threatened to bring down the state, Claudius was forced to act. Tacitus says it was the young and handsome Silius who encouraged Messalina to be rid of Claudius and marry him instead, and that he was even willing to adopt Messalina and Claudius's son Britannicus as his own. But it appears Messalina didn't need much encouragement, because in the year AD 48, as soon as Claudius had set out on a trip to Ostia, Rome's port, she performed the rite of marriage with Silius. Incredibly, they made no attempt to keep the wedding secret. They were obviously hoping to foment a revolution against Claudius, but the emperor's inner circle leapt into action and made sure that Claudius was made aware, ironically by one of his own mistresses, of what Messalina had done. Messalina's bacchanalian revels were broken up by Claudius's returning centurions. Caelius and his leading supporters were confronted and either executed or allowed to take their own lives. But Messalina attempted to draw off Claudius's anger by sending their children, Octavia and Britannicus, ahead to greet and embrace their father. Tacitus's account makes it sound as if Claudius was wavering, and that it was only the intercession of Claudius's freedman Narcissus, who feared that his master might be swayed if he interviewed Messalina personally, that saw her forced to take her own life that very same evening. Seneca, still sitting out on his Corsican rock, probably didn't find about all this for some days, but you can bet your bottom dollar he wouldn't have wasted any tears on Messalina's messy end. After the death of Messalina, Claudius, having now executed or divorced three wives, swore himself to celibacy. But either he had second thoughts, or the Senate intervened. After the disaster of Messalina, whose increasingly erratic behaviour could so easily have plunged Rome back into the chaos of civil war, maybe the Senate decided it was time for somebody who was not only sensible and intelligent, but who was also the only surviving daughter of the still universally revered Germanicus, who was also Claudius's brother. This would mean rewriting the laws of incest to allow an uncle to marry his niece, and the legislation was duly rushed through. Agrippina married her uncle, Claudius, on New Year's Day, AD 49. The bloodlines of emperor and empress were now closely intertwined, but, and perhaps more importantly for the security of Claudius's rule, the growing public disgust at Messalina's increasingly open and outrageous flaunting of her position was replaced with the respect and admiration for the last living daughter of the great Germanicus. Many commentators, ancient and modern, read a degree of calculation into Agrippina's rise to power. She'd deliberately kept her head down during Messalina's earlier years as Claudius's wife, something that her sister, Julia Lavilla, didn't have the sense to do, and which resulted in her exile and eventual murder at Messalina's behest. Agrippina only started to elevate her public profile as it became obvious that Messalina's behaviour had begun to go completely off the rails. In my opinion, Agrippina was definitely smart enough to be playing the long game, and probably saw, even way back in the early to mid AD 40s, that Messalina's sex drive might ultimately prove her downfall and create a situation that Agrippina could exploit to secure the future and safety of both herself and her son, by Gnaeus Domitius Ahenobarbus. That son had been born early morning, 15th December, in the year AD 37, in Antium, which is modern-day Anzio, 50-odd kilometres south of Rome. The child was named Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus, and I mention him here because he was to have a massive, possibly the biggest, influence on the life of our Lucius Annaeus Seneca, because this child, this little boy, was destined to grow up to become the Emperor Nero. The child, with his illustrious pedigree, had been another reason for Messalina's spite and hatred, as she had feared him, quite justifiably, as time would prove, as an alternative royal heir to Messalina's own son, Britannicus. But whatever the complexity of Agrippina's machinations to secure her own and her son's future, one other thing is an absolute certainty. Seneca must have jumped for absolute joy and punched the air in glee when he heard that Agrippina, ever his patroness and protector, had become the new empress. I think it highly likely that Seneca had been in contact with Agrippina throughout his entire period of exile on Corsica, especially so given their known acquaintance and earlier brushes with the state rulers, and especially since it was Seneca who'd fallen foul of Messalina and the charges of adultery levelled against Agrippina's sister Julia Livilla back in AD 41. Virtually as soon as Agrippina became Claudius's consort, she secured Seneca's recall from exile. The reason, she said, was that she needed a tutor for her son, the future Nero. That alone should tell us that the pair of them, Agrippina and Seneca, had maintained a relationship during Seneca's 8-odd years on Corsica. Tacitus, reporting Seneca's recall in his Annales, suggests it was one of Agrippina's first acts as empress, and goes on to imply that Seneca was already quite a literary celebrity, although that assessment is probably due to Tacitus's historical hindsight, as he, like Suetonius, was looking back on the period from a distance of a couple of generations. But what Tacitus does confirm in that same passage is that Seneca was somehow bound and indebted to Agrippina through what Tacitus calls past kindnesses. The link between the two must have been strong indeed, because not only did Agrippina secure Seneca's release from exile, but she also secured for him the political post of praetor, that is, the office on the Roman cursus honorum, or the course of honours, ladder of office type thing, immediately beneath the top level of consul. And although Tacitus suggests that an ulterior motive behind Agrippina's recall of Seneca and his appointment as tutor to her son was to gain an ally who had an axe to grind with Claudius for not standing in the way of his exile or recalling him earlier, it's important to note here that Claudius just stood aside and let Agrippina do it. Now that says a lot to me. It tells me, for a start, that Seneca's problem was not with Claudius, who, we remember, in AD 41 had stood up for Seneca in the Senate and got his original sentence for the charge of adultery with Julia mitigated from execution to exile. The historical evidence points squarely to the problem lying with Messalina. It was she who had pointed the finger at Seneca in the first place, and it was most probably she that had put an embargo on his recall from exile after Claudius's British triumph. But now, with Messalina safely executed, Claudius would, in my opinion, have been quite happy to see Seneca restored to favour. So that's Messalina and Agrippina. But what of the third woman I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast? What of Helvia, Seneca's mother? Well, to explain about her, we have to pan back to Corsica and the years between the sending of the consolation to Polybius and Seneca's eventual recall. After the abject failure of his attempt at recall in late AD 43 or early AD 44, Seneca's bitterness at his banishment continued. But at some stage during the following 4 years, he wrote a second consolatio or consolation, and this time he didn't rush it. It's called the Consolatio ad Helviam Matrem, or the Consolation to My Mother Helvia, and it is one of the most singular pieces of ancient literature to have come down to us. This is no lament for the dead. Well, it is in a way, but you have to stretch the definition of dead. It is, amazingly, a consolation addressed to Seneca's own mother to comfort her on the loss of her son, Seneca himself, in exile. Nothing else like it survives. In it, Seneca still bangs on about what a dump Corsica is, but this time he claims to have achieved a state of supreme stoic philosophical indifference to his plight, and he can take it or leave it. In fact, he even claims to see the advantages of exile. Now, a lot of ink has been spilled over this work, mostly by philosophical purists who ooh and ah about the magnificent depictions of ataraxia, or the fortress-like impregnability of the mind to passions. And sure, it can be read in that vein. I mean, Seneca certainly had enough time on his hands to hone his philosophical instincts after all. But, like everything Seneca writes, the Consolatio ad Helviam Matrem can be read in so many other ways as well. The work is impossible to date exactly. The content itself tells us that it was composed before Seneca's recall from exile in late AD 48, early AD 49. But I think there's enough evidence, if you look for it carefully enough, to suggest that it was composed after the death of Messalina in AD 48, exactly in that period before Agrippina was chosen to be Claudius's next wife. Seneca, you see, had had far more time to prepare this one, and it is far, far more subtle than the sledgehammer tactics employed in the Ad Polybium that had let him down so badly 4 years previously. Yes, the Ad Helviam is a consolatio, and a weird one at that, addressed to Seneca's mother and consoling her about himself as it does, but it contains all sorts of themes and situations that are directly relevant to the other two women who had such a huge impact on Seneca's life around that time, Agrippina and Messalina. I'd even go as far as to suggest that the Consolatio ad Helviam contains in its own right an appeal for Seneca to be recalled from exile. This time around, though, Seneca had had plenty of time to think, to plan, and to make his pitch using just the right language. And this time around, it worked. Well, in my next podcast, I'd explain exactly how a consolation addressed to his own mother about himself in exile helped Seneca get recalled to the capital of the empire. I really hope to see you all there.